I think it's more like a fix. They've been trying to fix the issues since they've launched GPT-5. I think the overall community has mixed feelings about it. They're still attached to the performance they were getting out of models like GPT-4o. Some of the community feels it's more of a cost optimization as opposed to really an issue with how warm the model is responding.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the finest minds in technology to distill down what's important in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists. We've got Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist and Manager, Hybrid Cloud Platform; Aaron Bautman, IBM Fellow and Master Inventor; and Mihai Crivetti, Distinguished Engineer, Agentic AI. All right, this episode, we're going to be covering a lot of interesting developments in the model space. We'll be talking about OpenAI's release of ChatGPT 5.1, the incredible performance we're seeing out of Kimi K2 Thinking, and we're going to end with a sort of interesting story about Microsoft and its release of agentic users. But first, we've got Eily with the news.
Hey everyone, I'm Eily McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. Here are this week's AI headlines. AI startup Anthropic said on Wednesday it would invest $50 billion in building data centers in the U.S. Elon Musk plans to build a massive AI chip fabrication plant to create chips for self-driving cars and robots. Baidu unveiled two artificial intelligence chips as Chinese tech giants ramp up their chip-making efforts. A new Tucson restaurant is using AI robotic cats to deliver food to customers' tables. For more, subscribe to the Think newsletter linked in the show notes. And now let's see what our experts think of ChatGPT 5.1.
Let's start with ChatGPT 5.1, which by default is the biggest story of the week. The big news here is that OpenAI has announced two of its kind of like latest editions of its model. So this will be ChatGPT 5.1 Instant, which is their sort of fast model, and ChatGPT 5.1 Thinking, which is their sort of like advanced deluxe model. Actually, I think, Aaron, I want to start with you. I think one of the most interesting things about this is typically when companies have touted new models in the past, they have tended to tout the fact that, look, they're so good at reasoning and they're so good against all these benchmarks. But the thing that OpenAI leads with, and I'll quote the blog post, is actually conversational style. So OpenAI says, quote, "We heard clearly from users that great AI should not only be smart, but also be enjoyable to talk to. GPT 5.1 improves meaningfully on both intelligence and communication style." And I guess, Aaron, I'm curious about what you think is leading to that, right? Like, are people just like not very impressed by performance on benchmarks anymore? Like, why is style such an important part of this launch?
Yeah. Style is critical, right? I think it develops a sense of empathy, you know, with the user and trust, so that, you know, if the model can have a more warm type personality and, you know, respond in a way, then it develops that relationship further, which I think we'll talk more a bit about that later in the podcast. But I want to mention what I really like about GPT 5.1 is this router mechanism, right? That whenever you're speaking with it, or, you know, having a conversation with it, with the style of which they have infused right into this model, right? It goes into one of the variants that it has, right? It can go into an instant or a thinking type variant, which is great, right? Because if I want to have a very quick, you know, instantaneous response with low response time, if that's the use case, then I more than likely can also coerce that router to go into that particular variant. If I need it to go into a deeper chain of thought, then it can go that way too. But then it joins back up in the middle, and that's where that stylistic choice comes in, right? To help develop, you know, that said relationship with the user, so it becomes more fluent.
Yeah, that's great. And I did want to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, Mihai, the question, kind of cheeky question I was going to ask is like, should we be covering this at all? You know, the movement from 5 to 5.1 is like maybe a little bit incremental. How big of a deal is this launch, you think?
I think it's more like a fix. They've been trying to fix the issues since they've launched GPT-5. I think the overall community has mixed feelings about it. They're still attached to the performance they were getting out of models like GPT-4o. And some of the community feels it's more of a cost optimization as opposed to really an issue with how warm the model is responding. Like, even I feel like, am I getting gaslit here? Is it like, you know, it's telling me, it's not that the model is bad. You see, these results are great. You don't like the results because it's so direct. Can you help me with this? No. So I was always wondering, is this actually a new model release? Or have they just fine-tuned the model or did some slight changes to the guardrails or did some slight changes to the prompts or the way they're, exposing the UI and APIs and all these other kind of things? It does look like they've actually trained a new model or at least iterated on the same GPT-5 family. So there are definitely some changes there. But to me, this still feels like they're trying to address the issues with the GPT-4o transition. There are some cost optimization challenges where Instant obviously provides much faster responses and this router provides cost efficiency. But there are mixed feelings within the communities. Like, for example, when I use one of these models, like just turn it up to 11, you know, just uh-huh. give me the good results. I don't care about
speed. I don't care. Think as much as possible.
Just think as much as possible and give me something that works. So that's going to get expensive fast.
Yeah, that's right. I have a friend who is just like, I just love the idea that when I push the button, it's working as hard as possible for me, even if the task is like very, very simple. So it's like that psychology, yeah. I think, is very fun.
Yeah, I'm paying what, €240, whatever, with tax for the GPT-4 Pro. GPT.
You take your money's worth.
Yeah. I'm going to get my money's worth.
Kautar, what did you think? Have you played with this model yet? What's your vibe check on 5.1?
Yeah, I played with it a little bit. I think I agree with my colleagues here are saying, but I feel they're trying to find a differentiation through the user experience and the empathy and the customization, especially in a world where raw intelligence is becoming a commodity, like thanks to models like Kimi K2. So they're trying to focus on maybe the fluid conversation, the daily use. One of the features that I liked is, the adaptive reasoning. So deciding when to think before reasoning, before responding basically to these complex questions, which seems to lead to better accuracy than the previous fast models while trying to remain quick on these simple tasks. So, but also like the tone that they're saying, designed to be warmer or even playful, reflecting basically this strategic choice to improve the conversational feel. So I don't know, are we seeing here segmentation of the markets, models that are focused on efficiency, like what we're seeing in the open source with Kimi K2, or models that are trying to win the user experience, the personality? So it's interesting to see here.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I did want to pick up a little bit before we move on to talking about Kimi K2 thinking on this point about customization. I think it's like very, very interesting that they kind of really sell the point like, oh, we are trying to make these models more customizable for you as a user, which is a little bit different, particularly in like an enterprise business case. It's not like Microsoft Word is like, oh, well, Microsoft Word's going to be customized for you specifically. But in AI, it does definitely feel like we're headed towards a world where everybody's experience of, say, ChatGPT is going to feel pretty different over time as they allow for more and more customization. And I guess, Kautar, how do you feel about that? Like, do you think that's like going to be just like where the market's going on some of this stuff?
Yeah, I think so. There definitely customization is going to be an important piece of it. And whether, there's also the cost per performance, the user experience, all of these things, kind of will segment, the market here, which models are we going to go to? But I think also trust and governance and compliance, those also will be very important. So it's going to be interesting to see how these things evolve. But definitely there is a war here. Is it the IQ war or the EQ war? So is it the, intelligence or the emotional Q quotients here? So are we going to segment along those two dimensions?
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I think it'd be very funny if it just turns out that there's going to be like kind of like a battle for like right brain users who just want the model to be quote as smart as possible, and then a battle for like left brain or those. I got it flipped, right? Like that, and there'll be a battle for I think like some users who just like want like much more natural conversation. And that's actually how the market will sort of divide over time. Ideally, you'd want a model that does both really, really well. But it seems like the companies are trying to like specialize a little bit over time.
Yeah, I mean, I could certainly see, you know, a reality where you could bring your own style or bring your own behavior, you know, through like an Allura weight or something like that, right? So you bring your own adapter and then you can upload it, plug it in, right? Or even mix together your own model. So it becomes hyper-personalized, you know, towards you, which would be pretty interesting. And this might be somewhat where, you know, this warmer tone, more conversational piece is going. And I wonder if GPT 5.2, right, or GPT 6, you know, might push the ecosystem a bit further, you know, down towards that way.
I don't want to say this is raising all sorts of red flags with me. I'm definitely in the camp of, you know, technical person that, you know, the only smart device in my home is a printer and I keep a gun next to it in case it makes a funny noise.
Yeah.
I have an inherent distrust of any system that learns about me, learns about my behavior, adapts over time. Because the only thing I'm seeing in my mind is like advertisement, influencing my decisions, learning and optimizing its responses to drive my behavior. So I actually like simple systems. I like my AI, like I like my headphones with a wire, with switches I can toggle on or off. I want to be the one in control. I don't want the router. I don't want the memory. I don't want it to learn about me. I want to tell it what it needs to know every time. So I think there's a balance there to strike.
Yeah, yeah. You're actually even against the router. So I guess like the thing that Aaron finds so interesting, you're kind of like, I don't want it to tell you to decide how much to think.
Yeah, this is something happening whether we want it or not. Unfortunately, you know, these customizations and adaptation and so on, it is the more we use these systems, the more they're learning about our behaviors and so on. And I think whether we have control or not, I don't know, these systems, they're not giving us control. And that's something maybe another design point, you know. Can these AI systems give the users control, whether they want to learn about our behavior? We want them to learn about us and things like that and adapt. Or we want maybe just simpler interactions and kind of robotics ones without any, you know, kind of implied intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want it to be too smart in a certain way. So. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Another model I think it's a cover, which I think is a really interesting counterpoint to the ChatGPT 5.1 story, is the hype around Kimi K2 thinking. So just to kind of quickly review, Kimi K2 is a model produced by a Chinese AI startup called Moonshot AI. And they dropped this model, which is an open source model, which incredibly has been able to claim superior performance against even proprietary models on a set of pretty big benchmarks, right? So on Chimene's last exam, they're doing great. On BrowseComp, they're doing great. On SuiBench, they're doing great. And this is a pretty, I think, interesting story, right? Which is, I think, for a long time on MOE, we've talked about, like, when will open source, you know, triumph over the proprietary models? And this seems to be a case where, like, the open source model is doing at or better than all the proprietary models. And I guess, Mihai, I'll give you a chance to kind of lay out your conspiracy theory, because before the episode, you were saying, you know, maybe the timing of ChatGPT 5.1 is a little suspicious with K2 thinking. Do you want to just quickly lay that out?
Yeah, let's quickly increment that one, because something big is coming in the open source space. And that's my theory there, that there's definitely a response in the market to this very, very powerful open source model.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I mean, that's maybe the cynical view on sort of like, oh, you're going to tell all these like style and emotional communication things because now you're getting beat on all the benchmarks. I guess, Katra, maybe let me take a step back, though, is like, how... like, are benchmarks still a useful way of even looking at this, right? So obviously, like, the companies care a lot about it. But I think on this app, on the show, we have talked about, like, well, are we kind of reaching the end of the usefulness of some of these benchmarks in terms of actually showing performance? You know, obviously, this is a milestone for open source, but does it really say that open source is now better than proprietary models? Like, how do you read these results?
I think, you know, if we look at the results and the benchmarks, I mean, it's saying something. So, I mean, there must be a way to evaluate these models. And right now, the only way that's, you know, kind of viable is benchmarking, trying these things. And also on these standard benchmarks. So what this is saying is this is actually a big open source milestone. It is a challenge to the entire closed AI economy. So if the best model in the world is open weight, the center of gravity in AI shifts from secret models to shared ecosystems. And so this is also, this move is positioning China also as a serious contender in this global open model race, which is paralleling, you know, what, you know, kind of the Linux moment in the AI era. So there, you know, I think the results are showing really superior performance using the MoE architecture with 1 trillion parameters, with only activating 32 billion per inference per token. So there is a big focus here on compute efficiency, as much as also the capability one. And another thing is the license that they have is very permissive, but also strategic. So they're saying, you know, if you're doing this at a massive scale, you have to mention KimiKeitu.
Yeah, I think the rule, as I have written down here, is 100 million monthly active users.
Yes.
Or 20 million USD per month in revenue. So
Yes. So it's like anything that is related to massive scale, you know, give us the attribution. And so for enterprises, you know, this open weight dominance really means that you can finally bring, you know, top tier reasoning in-house, you know, without, you know, with much lower costs. So, and this is kind of, you know, it could be the start of this open apex era where proprietary advantages, you know, is decaying faster than ever. So I think for big tech, the open outperformers, you know, like K2 thinking, they're forcing the question is how do you justify like a 20 million monthly burn rate when community models can really close the gap? And I think here the next frontier is may not be maybe the model quality, but also the integration. Who builds the most trusted, compliant, and secure deployment pipelines? So I think that's going to become super important here. So it's not just about building the most intelligent and most powerful model, but also about building a model that you can integrate and trust, and it is compliant, and you have these secure deployment pipelines.
Aaron, do you want to make a forecast for where we're going from here? I mean, I think the old rule used to be, well, open source was going to lag behind, quote, state of the art by X months. Now we're in a world where if you buy Mihai's theory, it's basically like now open source is ahead in some ways of the proprietary models. You know, are we in for a long period of kind of rough parity, I think, between open source and proprietary? Or do you feel like actually over time, open source is now going to even accelerate further? Like we'll start talking about like, oh, well, how long is it going to take for OpenAI to catch up relative to open source? Curious about how you think about that.
Yeah. So real quick, but before I answer that, I want to just pull the thread a bit on, you know, what about these standards and benchmarks? You know, around this, I want to make the point that I think a third party and independent assessment needs to be made, right, around this model, because I was looking around and we can make stats tell us anything, right? You know, I can say, hey, if I walk outside and it's 0 degrees, you know, Celsius, for example, that it's healthy, right? So, I mean, I'm not sure how much I would really buy, you know, lots of the, you know, performance that, you know, Kimi did on like the browse comp, the SW bench, the live code bench, you know, those pieces and elements until a third party tests this model. All right. So that's a one point, right? The other is that I don't think this is an open source wins, proprietary is finished, you know, argument. I do think we're in a clear inflection point where open source models can compete and complete some of the highest levels of reasoning tasks. But I always like to think this, you know, KimiKeitu isn't just thinking, it's overthinking for all of us, right? So that being said, you know, there's no free lunch, right? We need to pick the right tool for the problem that we're going to use and put them together, right? And I think one of the biggest areas that Kimi has an issue with, A, is trust and transparency. Even though it is open source, right? Again, I want to see a third party, you know, show us, you know, what the standards are and what the benchmarks are like, you know, within the real world here, right? And then also the ecosystem, right? You know, I used to host my own models, very difficult to do, right? I like to go and use like a Watson X, for example, or a, you know, Bedrock that hosts models for me so that I can use the tooling that's available. And I think, for example, we just talked about GPT 5.1, you know, I think the tooling and that part is very much ahead. So I think there's pros and cons, right, for all of these. And we're moving into a world where we're going to ensemble these types of models together within these very large graphs, you know, that are conversational. And then they use these like A2A protocols to communicate together.
I guess maybe a final question to Mihai before we move on to the last topic I wanted to cover was, I know the reaction you just had to 5.1 was, it's learning about me, it's deciding how much to think. Like, I just want it to be simple, right? Like, I just don't want that much. And I guess, is it ultimately, like, I guess a reason to kind of like want these open source models, I guess, is just like you have more control than you would a proprietary model. I guess, Mihai, the question that just to kind of get it to a question is like, how common do you think you are, right? Like, do you feel like the average consumer
wants
this level of control? No, okay.
I don't think they're necessarily aware of it. But as a developer or somebody who builds AI agents, who builds AI tools, I'm looking at Kimi K2 and I think, look, 300 sequential tool calls, 256K of context, 10 times cheaper than GPT-5, and I can run it there. Okay, at one token per second with a distilled model, and it's a 1 terabyte download, and my wife is going to kill me when I start the servers, but I can run it. I can run it myself. It goes through no API. Nobody's looking at my data. Nobody's putting a router in front of it. Nobody gets to make those choices for me. And it was kind of funny. When I was flying out last week, I had GPT-OSS 20 billion on my laptop and I was able to do coding. Like, that level of control, the ability to run these models locally, I think is priceless. And the fact that we now have models within the open source space that can compete, genuinely compete with some of the frontier models, I think is just awesome.
Yeah, one of the biggest claims was that it could call 200 to 300 tools, right? That's a big claim. And, you know, there's long horizon reasoning. I would really like to see that validated. And, you know, it's... You know, calling external tools, that's a safety issue as well, right? So that's something to be very cognizant about.
All right, last story of the day that I wanted to cover is kind of this fun story. The Register, the kind of tech news site, basically reported on this kind of interesting, not really a leak, but some sort of teasing that Microsoft is doing about what it's working on in terms of agents for the enterprise. And specifically, it's releasing or planning to release what they're calling, quote, a new class of AI agents that operate as independent users within the enterprise workforce. So the quote here, which I think is just fun to read, is like, each embodied agent has its own identity, dedicated access to organizational systems and applications, and the ability to collaborate with humans and other agents. These agents can attend meetings, edit documents, communicate via email and chat, and perform tasks autonomously. So this is a kind of fun dream. We've been talking about AI agents all year, but this is maybe like the first one where a company is starting to make the claim like, oh yeah, we're going to just have like a drag and drop coworker who will be an agent that will operate on the enterprise exactly the same way as like any other user does. And so I guess, Mihai, I see you making a face, so maybe I'll call on you first, particularly someone who works on agents all the time. Is this marketing hype? Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea?
I'll go back to my comment on printers, you know, just a printer on the gun next to it in case it makes funny noises. As somebody who's actively building security software for AI agents, I'm building ContextForge, which is a gateway for agents and MCP servers. This is great news. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be hundreds of clients interested in how do we secure authentication, authorization, governance, how do we ensure PII data doesn't leak. But from an enterprise perspective, it's like this can be a security nightmare. Not only do you have to manage the user's identity, now you have potentially hundreds or thousands of agents who are moving data left and right with no accounting for governance, compliance, the UAI Act, GDPR, not filtering necessarily your PII data, with no clear way to do evaluations or to evaluate their performance. And it won't be long before, you know, your boss is now Cortana. You're reporting into an AI agent. Your reports are AI agents. You're bringing your agents into the conversation. It's not necessarily something new. So even on GitHub today, I can trigger GitHub Copilot to help review my PRs. There are already agents on Microsoft Teams. I'm building one of these agents for Office 365 that calls our Consulting Advantage platform. So these things kind of already exist in many organizations. The part I don't necessarily feel comfortable with is what level of control do organizations have when all these hundreds of agents start popping around in various catalogs, in Teams, in all the product suites, and CIO offices are running around, how do I turn this off? How do I turn this off? How do I ensure data integrity? So I think this is inevitable. The only thing that feels off about this story is how much choice. Is this like a new product that we can buy? Or is this something that's just going to happen to us? From now on, there's going to be that cute dog from Windows XP bouncing around and saying, I'm here to help you search for your files.
So Kautar, maybe good for business teams, but a nightmare for CIOs and CISOs. But isn't Microsoft, I mean, Microsoft is the world leader, right, at this kind of compliance. Why are they pushing down this route if it comes with like all of the kind of like crazy security risks that Mia is pointing out?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see, you know, this new direction that Microsoft is pushing forward. So, but, you know, this is, you know, we're seeing here the shift from having a tool, AI as a tool, to AI as a teammate. And I agree, you know, here with Matt Mihai, said this can be like a compliance nightmare here. So, because, you know, governance and auditing. So if it's an agentic user with its own identity, and if it violates a compliance policy, who is accountable? Is it the admin who created it? You know, the human who trained it? The organization really needs a unified audited log that can differentiate between human and agent actions. And so I think there are lots of interesting, you know, implications here. This is pretty disruptive with, you know, these agentic users, because they're really full-fledged user objects. They have, you know, email, identity, and so on.
Yeah, they can do
and
everything.
Right now, yes, you know, currently they might be augmenting us, but maybe at some point they might be replacing also layers in the organization. So, you know, I think there are some, you know, interesting pieces to this, but there are also scary pieces to this that we have to be, you know, watching for. And I think the discussion here is, you know, this is organizational and legal implications of giving AI kind of a corporate identity. And this is a real profound shift from tooling to teammates and coworkers. And what the implications on this, you know, for HR, for governance, for auditing. There is also maybe a cultural shock to this. You know, how will humans, employees react to teammates that doesn't need breaks, works 24/7 and potentially accesses all their files? And so this is a major change management challenge that I think HR departments are not ready for.
Yeah. And I want to end the episode by taking maybe like a little bit of a step into the future, right? Because Aaron, where my head goes on this is like, if you've ever worked, you know, if you work at a big company, there are people that you work with that you maybe never meet in person, you largely experience through Slack. Like, I just have this vision that in the future, you're like, you know, someone's trying to start an office romance only to discover that, you know, the person they've been working with is actually an agent, right? Like that may very well be in our future, the minute you instantiate like user agents that operate like this in the office. I don't know, do you have any wild predictions, Aaron, for like the future of the office place once you start unleashing these all over the place?
I mean, well, first, I would love to have an AI agent to cook breakfast. I mean that'd be fantastic, right? I did look around, you know, at what Microsoft's strategy looked to be, right? And it looks like, you know, this somewhat started with a paper that they had called the Agentic Economy, right? But then I think, as the field noticed, that there's a lot of security, you know, pieces around this. So then they had groups working on like zero trust agents, securing and governing autonomous agents, you know, with Microsoft security. You know, so they're attacking, I think, both sides to try to create this agentic architecture with eval frameworks and governance, you know, to help people feel more comfortable. But I could see a future where, you know, there's what, over 8 billion people on the planet, where there's more agents than there are people on the planet, right? Because
if you count Copilot as an agent, where like, you know, the population of agents operating society is actually quite large now, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can copy paste agents. You can clone agents. Agents can create potentially other agents, right? So this fractal, you know, piece, you know, goes on and on. But I do think the blurring between what is a human, what is an agent is going to become very, very difficult. I think there's going to be hybrid humans and agents working together, you know, where even if you are talking with a human, are you really talking to the intent of the human? Or is a human simply almost like a puppet of the agent, you know, feeding it what to say, right? So that trust and transparency about, you know, this blending of these biomimetic, you know, pieces all working together might be hard to parse, but I think it's something that we need to get ready for, right? And even prepare our kids, you know what they could be in for. With
yeah, how do you deal with it when your boss is a real jerk, but he's Cortana, you know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's going to be. And the other part too is that these agents are going to manifest itself within the physical world. You know, so, you know, the way that they change the physical world are going to give us other confusing signals, right? Is, you know, what changed the color of my TV, or what changed the channel, or what changed the color of this light, for example, is the small things. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's going to be a really interesting, the effect of computing, right? In essence, I think is going to be combined with agentic agents. But yeah, it's... It'll be fun, concerning, and interesting, all of it together.
All at the same time. Right. Mihai, do you want to have the final word here on the episode?
With consumption-based pricing, so how long before your agents start to attend every meeting or email everyone, and they're going to charge you 0.01 cent for every interaction, and, you know, maybe even impersonate humans. Like, you've seen that YouTube comment, it was like starting comment, hey, human here, is like, really? It's like, I don't think you're a human. But that could also violate the UAI Act and start ramping up some of those fines.
Yeah, what I was also thinking on the agentic economy is that agents will pay us, right? That we become businesses, right? And then we take payment from agents to get access to a certain element of data.
The agent has decided it's more cost effective to delegate to a human.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dark and dangerous future. All right, well, that's a great note to end on. And that's all the time that we have for today. Kautar, Aaron, Mihai, always great to have you on the show. And thanks for joining all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.